You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the east region of eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois. I'm your host, Robin Johnson. And today's show focuses on a major issue on the Iowa side of the river, although I'm sure, well, I know that it has some, there'll be concerns on the Illinois side as well, and perhaps more places. This issue is voiced in a book whose author is my guest today. The issue is water quality. The book is The Swine Republic, Struggles with the Truth About Agriculture and Water Quality. And the author is Chris Jones. Chris has a really interesting and diverse background as a scientist working in government, academia, and the private sector. So he brings a unique view to this topic. He's an avid outdoorsman. In the book, I really enjoyed as much as anything his descriptions of fishing, hunting, etc. And he really likes the Driftless area, which for folks out here, we know where that's at. It's north of the Quad City area. Chris, thanks for being my guest today.
Well, great, great. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're a brave individual. You take on a lot of the power structure in Iowa. And this book is blunt. And for people interested, I would recommend it. It's very blunt, but it's approachable. For a scientist, you write in a way that people that are non-scientists like me can understand. But let's just start at the foundation here. When did this issue really, I guess, catch your attention enough to write so passionately about it?
Well, I'm from Iowa originally, the Des Moines area, but I lived in Minnesota for a long time, and I moved back to Iowa in 2003 and worked for the Des Moines Water Works and looked out my office window at the Raccoon River every day. And I thought, where's the outrage here? This was a river that the city of Des Moines was using as a source of municipal drinking water. And, you know, it just the condition of it was so bad. I just wondered, how is this not being discussed? And cussed and disgust, I guess, is, you know, the term. And so that's when my interest about this really began. You know, I had been an outdoorsman and had interest in the environment and so forth prior to that time. But it was when I moved back to Iowa in 2003 where I really became interested in the condition of things.
What's causing the water quality issues? I'm just going to be very basic here for listeners that may not be as aware.
So, you know, in Iowa, our big thing is nutrient pollution. The state did a science assessment prior to its nutrient reduction strategy, and Illinois also has a nutrient reduction strategy. The science assessment showed that about 94% of the nitrogen and about 90% of the phosphorus was coming from agriculture. And so we know in Iowa that agriculture is the primary source of water pollution. There's no question about that. It's unfortunate that sometimes we still have to argue about where it's coming from, but you know, there's really no question about that. We have other issues as well. We have a lot of E. coli impairments in our streams. That's the most common impairment in Iowa for streams. And of course, we have a lot of livestock production here in Iowa. When we look at farming in Iowa compared to Illinois, the big difference is Iowa has a lot more livestock. And so that has an impact on our streams and lakes in terms of pathogens and other things.
Well, is so with this information presented, I mean, I guess, what's the reaction of people that are in a position to do something about this? It seems like you've got your facts in order in presenting this, and the book details that. I mean, what's the reaction when this information is presented as far as the action that might need to be taken, and why hasn't it been taken?
Well, you know, a lot of people get mad at me, but not very many people tell me I'm wrong. And so it's, you know, the And I always say when I write things and do programs that, look, people don't have to believe me. All they have to do is go out and look at the condition of their lakes and streams. I mean, look at them, smell them, see if that's what you think they should look like and smell like. And, you know, the answer is no. And so people have a understanding of what's going on here, I think. I think, you know, we've had... You know, I think my book and my writing has been this sort of the emperor has no clothes sort of thing. And so the state, our state government and the industry has been telling us for decades now that, you know, either we're making progress or it's not that bad in the first place. And I think there's a lot of fatigue on the issue. And I think, you know, my stuff sort of told people what they knew already, right? And I think it articulated in a way that resonated with people. And so I think, you know, it's a matter of priorities, right? It's a matter of priorities. And so in Iowa, agriculture dominates about 80% of our land. The industry has just a really tenacious control of state government and also of many of our institutions. And so there's been this really been a real reluctance to challenge the status quo here and to challenge the establishment. And I think the book and the rest of my writing kind of allows people to mentally vent a little bit when they read it, that, yeah, it's about time somebody said something. So.
I thought it was interesting, again, as somebody who's kind of learning about this stuff, for the first time, trying to understand this better, changes in the farm economy over the years, which I thought was really interesting. How the farm economy has been more focused on just a couple of things, it's had negative implications for water quality. Can you kind of walk through that a little bit?
So sure. And, you know, we know that nature likes diversity, right? We know nature likes to have a lot of species out there, and whether it's in a natural condition or, you know, if it's in a human created condition, the more species you have, the better. Well, across large swaths of our state and other parts of the Corn Belt, we only have two species, corn and soybeans. And so when you look at Iowa agriculture over the first 100 years or so, we had real diverse farming systems where, you know, yes, we grew corn. We've always grown a lot of corn here, but we also had alfalfa, oats, other small grains. We had wheat. Iowa was once the number one apple producing state, believe it or not. And so we grew lots of crops here. And then in the 1960s, we began this transition from diverse cropping systems to ones with only two species, and now sometimes only one with corn. And so that's given us these undesirable environmental outcomes that we have in terms of water quality, especially with the nutrients. And then, you know, in terms of livestock, you know, in 1980, we had about 65,000 farmers in Iowa that raised hogs, and the average farmer was raising about 200 hogs then. Now we have about 4,000 farmers raising hogs, and the average number that they raise is about 5,000. And so this concentration of animals into the hands of only a few farmers has made handling the waste just this colossal challenge. And so, you know, you have one farmer that's maybe handling the fecal waste equivalent of a city of, you know, maybe 50,000 people. And, you know, how does that work, right? There's going to be bad things happen. It's just, you know, intuitive that we're going to get negative consequences from that. And so as we've concentrated down to two crops, and as we've concentrated the animals into the hands of only a few farmers, that has produced these negative environmental consequences.
Has the concentration of two crops specifically affected that? It's is it more fertilizer, different types of fertilizer, seeds. I mean, how, give our listeners an idea of what that means as far as water quality.
So when we look at the history of Iowa and how corn was grown and where the nitrogen came from, and so prior to soybeans coming in, a lot of the nitrogen came from legumes. And so we grew clovers, we grew alfalfa, and other legume crops that sequester nitrogen from the atmosphere. And then we also fertilized corn with manure too. When soybeans came in, soybeans do not fix enough nitrogen for the following corn crop. And so that required the introduction of commercial fertilizer. And so the mass production of commercial fertilizer after World War II went hand in hand with the introduction of soybeans. And so soybeans are, you know, we don't fertilize them typically. I mean, some farmers do, but typically soybeans don't require fertilizer. But soybeans are also kind of what we call a leaky crop, where they leak a lot of nutrients to the surrounding environment. And so now we have a corn which is fertilized heavily, and we have soybeans that are not fertilized heavily, but they still leak a lot of nutrients that are left over from the previous year's corn crop. And so this has really caused the degradation of, you know, pretty much all of the state's water resources.
And it doesn't affect just Iowa either. I mean, it's talk about the impact down in the Gulf of Mexico.
So absolutely not. This is a continental scale problem, right? It's a colossal problem, and we're polluting, you know, we're killing off part of an ocean 2,000 miles away, right? And that's a real sign that what we're doing is not very sustainable. And so the nutrients ultimately get into the Mississippi River. They flow down to the Gulf of Mexico, discharge down there at the Bird's Foot, south of New Orleans. The nutrients catalyze these big algae blooms in the Gulf of Mexico. When the algae die, their decomposing cells consume oxygen, and then it creates this dead zone in the near coastal areas off of Louisiana and Mississippi, and affects the commercial fishing industry down there. The fish and the shrimp and whatnot need to move away from that low oxygen zone to waters further offshore. And so, especially the smaller fishermen that don't have the resources to travel 50 or 100 miles offshore every day to fish, it really has an impact on them.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Chris Jones, who's the author of a really good book, came out 2023, called The Swine Republic, Struggles with the Truth About Agriculture and Water Quality. A lot of our listeners may have heard of Chris before because he's been kind of, I'll compare you a little bit, a lonely voice in the wilderness talking about this issue, although there have been others with you. Chris has been outspoken in the degradation of Iowa's water quality. He's taking on a lot of big, powerful players in Iowa, and for that he's to be commended, I think. We're talking a little bit about his book today. I want to emphasize too here for our listeners out there that who may be thinking this is just a part of the partisan divide we have in our country. It's not. You focus on bipartisan blame here. Can you discuss that a little bit, please?
So absolutely, it's bipartisan. And I would say, you know, and I get a lot of criticism from Democrats, especially by talking about this. But you know, Democrats talk a good game on this, but in terms of policy, they really have not been any better than Republicans on this water pollution that's sourced to agriculture. And so we see, 60% of our corn in Iowa goes to ethanol. Well, you know, corn is a highly polluting crop. It's our most polluting crop. You know, almost all Democrats are pro-ethanol for our motor vehicles. And, you know, this is really something that doesn't contribute to the common good, the ethanol. We see that it really doesn't have much greenhouse gas benefit. The other air pollution that we have from automobiles really has declined quite a lot with emission standards and not ethanol. And so we see some research that shows that ethanol even increases greenhouse gas emissions. But yeah, Democrats have been very pro-ethanol. We see, liberals like Amy Klobuchar and Sherrod Brown and others across the country that from the Farm Belt that are very much pro-ethanol. And so, there's a real knee-jerk instinct amongst Democrats to blame Republicans for this, but that just is not right. And part of the issue is Iowa has had the first in the nation caucus for so long. And so all the presidential candidates have all had to come here and kneel at the altar of ethanol to try to win the Iowa caucus. And so I think, the fact that the Democratic Party is no longer coming to Iowa first is a real positive step. And maybe, the fact that both parties are so committed to this, maybe that's coming to an end.
Yeah, I was reading the book and going through, and by the way, for our listeners, this book is made up of, I don't know the precise number, but it's short essays you've written on your blog, just short 3 or 4 pages. And so it's very readable, very approachable. Again, Chris does a good job of breaking down technical aspects so that somebody like me can understand. But I'm reading through this and you're taking on what's called the industrial agriculture complex. And then you get into taking on ethanol and I'm like, oh boy, he's this guy's fearless. Do you think, and this, I just got to ask this, it's more political, but do you think without Iowa as the first in the nation presidential contest that the buildup for ethanol would have taken place?
So that's a good question. Tom Harkin, who was a senator here for a long time, he was very much pro-ethanol. And, would it have happened? I don't know. I think it probably would have on some level. Would we have this nationwide requirement of blending were it not for the presidential caucus issue? I think probably not, but I do think we would have had really a lot of pressure to use ethanol as a vehicle fuel with the caucus or not. But I do think what the caucus did was it entrenched it, right? It entrenched it, and it's, as we see today, it's going to be very difficult to unentrench ethanol.
Yeah, the figures you gave on the amount of corn that goes into ethanol right now is staggering. And but I read on, and you get into the carbon pipeline issue as well, which is a current issue. It surfaced some in the presidential race. Can you talk about that a little bit as well?
Well, firstly, I want your listeners to know one little fact about ethanol. The amount of calories in the corn that we use to produce ethanol in this country exceeds the amount of calories that we put into our bodies. And so that's how much goes into corn ethanol. And so when we make ethanol out of corn, CO2 is emitted from that process, from the fermentation process. Quite a lot of CO2 is emitted from the fermentation process. And so for corn to be designated as an, or excuse me, for ethanol to be designated as an advanced biofuel, they're going to have to figure something out about this CO2 that's being emitted during fermentation. And so the idea that came up was to put it in a pipeline and send it up to North Dakota and entomb it down in the bedrock. And then if the pipeline people did this, they would get $85 a ton carbon credit. And so there's a lot of money to be made on this. The other thing is this will very likely enable EPA to declare ethanol an advanced biofuel. And so it will entrench it for a long time. And the industry sees that the demand for liquid fuels is declining, at least in the context of automobiles. And so the idea would be a lot of this ethanol would then go to aviation fuel and what they're calling sustainable aviation fuel, which in my mind is pretty dubious that it's sustainable. And so that's the whole scheme here that's happening, is they're trying to get these pipes in the ground to pump this CO2 from Iowa and other places, Illinois too, and entomb it in bedrock. And then the pipeline people will get this very lucrative carbon credits that's being proposed by the federal government.
That's a nice segue into my next question. Government's got a role in this because of some of the policies it's put forth that almost incentivize this.
Absolutely. I mean, I say this all the time. The ethanol industry exists for one reason and one reason only, and that's government policy. Would it exist without the renewable fuel standard and the other incentives and subsidies for corn production? It absolutely would not. We are, you know, right now we are the largest oil producing country in the world. We export oil. And so how does it make sense to, you know, buy expensive seed, fertilize it with anhydrous ammonia that has a greenhouse gas component to produce that, and then drive tractors across the field with diesel fuel, and then harvest the grain and haul it to an ethanol plant, and then go through all the gyrations to turn the corn into ethanol? Just does not make sense. It's, you know, it's almost a make-work type thing is how I see it. And there's so many other things that we could be doing to affect climate change, but, you know, this huge opportunity cost that goes along with ethanol. I mean, that's what it is. It's an opportunity cost, and we could be investing all this effort into other things that would produce better environmental outcomes.
That leads to my next question, which is, your book does talk about solutions you propose to this water quality issue. Can you discuss some of those, please?
Well, we know these diverse crop rotations produce better environmental outcomes, including water quality. And so there's a guy at Iowa State University. He's retired now. His name is Matt Liebman. He spent his career studying these diverse rotations, a five-year rotation of corn, soybeans, 2 years of alfalfa, and then oats. And the water quality outcomes from that system are far superior than just the corn soybean system. The other thing about it is farmers can make as much money under these diverse rotations as they can with just the 2 year rotation. The problem we have is these, when you diversify the farm, that increases the amount of work that needs to be done on this farm. And so with these GMO crops, they're very easy to grow. You really don't have to work that much. You know, if you don't have livestock, you're really only working about 6 or 8 weeks out of the year if you're just growing corn and soybean. And so that is a big obstacle to converting from the two crop rotation to a more diverse rotation. But, you know, look, if the industry wants to continue with the two crop rotation, they can, right, under the current framework. But because we subsidize and indemnify it, you know, I suggest that the taxpayer ought to have a say in how it's operated. And so that means laws, right? And so we know there's certain things that just do not make sense, and they're almost universally acknowledged as bad practices. And so why don't we have laws that would restrict those things? And so in Iowa, I talk about fall tillage. We know it's dumb. We know it increases nutrient loss. We know it increases soil erosion. Why are we doing that? It's not necessary in the current production system. We allow the application of manure onto snow. Why do we do that? Snow and frozen ground. It's dumb. We know when it warms up, those nutrients gone, right? Gone to the stream network. We allow farmers to apply way, way more nutrient than what they need. And so we know that statewide in Iowa, it's probably similar in Illinois, farmers are about 30 to 40% above what Iowa State is recommending for a corn crop. We need to get farmers' nutrient inputs aligned with what the crops are going to use. And so those are a few of the things. We need to buffer streams. We have a terrible time here in Iowa with farmers cropping right up to the edge of the stream. Why do we allow that? We need to ban that. Increases stream bank erosion. It increases phosphorus loss, especially. And so there's some things that are very intuitive. And so until the industry is ready to embrace a more sustainable production system with more diverse crops, I think we need to have some laws that restrict the current activity.
We got about a minute left. I just wanted to offer that, you know, farmers around here, when the topic of water quality environmentalism comes up, they talk about how they try to be good conservationists. Is that the response you've gotten there? And I know that the response is always voluntary versus regulation, but in a minute, minute and a half, can you kind of sum that up, the response from farmers?
Well, I would just ask, is there anyone on earth that hasn't met a farmer that identifies as a conservation farmer? You know, I've never met one. They all say they're conservation farmers. And so then that begs the question, why is the condition of our streams the way it is? Obviously, their idea of conservation does not align very well with the idea of clean water, right? And so I think we have the idea of conservation farmer oftentimes is very much pigeonholed into a soil erosion picture, right? And not so much a nutrient loss picture. And so I think, you know, look, farmers, we know farmers don't want to lose their soil, but they don't feel very badly about losing their nutrients.
Well, I have to sum up, Chris, and say you were compared in the book to George Orwell. And as somebody who's read George Orwell, I would have to agree with that, with your writing style. There's humor in here. There's facts. And it's a good book. I recommend it to folks. Again, The Swine Republic. Provocative title, Struggles with the Truth About Agriculture and Water Quality by Chris Jones. It's out, it's available, and I know you're still making efforts across the state on this issue, and I just want to thank you again for taking the time to be my guest today on Heartland Politics.
All right, happy to be here, Robin. Thanks for the invitation.
Listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK Quad Cities NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.